Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, where we cover trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world, our communities, and bring them a mental health perspective. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and I'm joined today by Dr. Keita Franklin. Dr. Franklin is a licensed social worker and the chief clinical officer at PsychHub. She has 25 years of experience in suicide prevention, in mental health, and substance abuse. Dr. Franklin has served as a senior executive in both the Department of Defense and the Department of Veteran Affairs, where she served as a principal advisor on all matters related to suicide prevention. We are so grateful to have a national leader in suicide prevention with us today. Keita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is really nice to have you here with us. I'm excited about this topic, and it's an important one. You know, as we come into to talk about suicide today, I'd like it if you could to kind of set a framework of understanding. I know that there are a lot of layers and dynamics that underlie suicide. So as we start, could you please just start us by giving a sense of what's kind of an overarching idea of what suicide is and why this is such an important topic for us all to be addressing?
Sure, definitely. You know, as a social worker, I was exposed to suicide as a phenomenon very early on in my career, but it probably wasn't until later on when I was responsible for large military organizations and we started to see a spike in suicide that I actually started to dig deep into the phenomenon to try to understand, you know, what goes on when an individual, you know, starts to think about ending their life by suicide. And you definitely said it right. It is a complex issue, but in the way of framing it, you know, it's the 10th leading cause of death in the nation, generally speaking, across all age demographic groups. So, I mean, I don't like to say that it's a common phenomenon, but I mean, the fact that it's rated so high in terms of the leading causes of death, it's even the second, sometimes they'll say the third leading cause of death for younger people. And so it is a serious issue and it does, you know, require the entire nation to come to bear to make sure that we're doing everything we can for people. And I'm happy to talk to you more about some of the reasons behind and sort of what we know and what we don't know about it. But that's a little bit of framing anyways.
Yeah, I think that's really great. We hear about it. Suicide as a term is used, but we sometimes don't appreciate the level of its prevalence and the impact that it's having on all age groups. We think it's maybe just a certain age group or a certain, you know, category of folks, but it really spans the whole developmental life cycle, doesn't it? And youth are really at risk in a pretty significant way.
Yeah, we talk in the field about people want to learn, you know, who's most at risk. And there are some demographic groups that are more at risk. And you described one, youth, but, you know, definitely doesn't discriminate. And we saw that last year when we saw nationally the death of well-known people like Kate Spade, yeah. Anthony Bourdain. We've seen military general officers that die by suicide. And, you know, we always believe that one suicide is too many. And while it impacts well-known people, there are also families across America that have been impacted that are no less important.
Yeah, agreed. Well, let's dive in a little bit more. You know, we're talking about the underlying factors that go into suicide. Why do people take their lives?
Yeah, and it's not an easy answer. I'll tell you that right up front. It is not a simple sort of one phrase answer. And I learned that, you know, early on when I worked in the Pentagon, covering down suicide for all the military branches, the very senior levels of leadership in that building and also at the Congress would ask me the same question, you know, what are the top three reasons that troops end their life by suicide? And can you give them to me in rank order? And, you know, it was never that easy. It's a lot more complex than that. I always say that there's probably 20 to 25 plus risk factors. And one of the important things to know about it is, you know, people have this tendency to think that if someone dies by suicide, they have a mental health problem. And right. that clearly it's a mental health issue. And I offer to you that it's not always the case. You know, what we see in the data is that half of those that die by suicide have a known mental health problem and about half don't. And that's a little bit what makes it so difficult to treat, because early on in the field of suicide prevention, we did tend to treat it with mental health assets. Like if we could just get them into therapy and get them on the best meds, all would be well. But, you know, fast forward many years, you realize it's like, it's a public health problem. Yes. And it really, in some cases, we see people struggling with legal issues, with relationship problems, with, you know, the inability to problem solve, like they just black and white thinking. We see people struggling with medical issues sometimes, late in life, stage four cancer that decided to take their life in their own hands. And their words of their family members when I've, you know, visited with their family members, die with dignity. And then you see other situations where, you know, they've gotten a DUI and they've, you know, they're the top cop in their city and, you know, policemen don't get DUIs and policemen don't get in trouble and they can't see a way out and everything in between. So it's a little complicated.
Well, I like that. I like the point you're saying that, you know, the percentages of those that do it in terms of mental health issues have something related to a mental health issue. It could be depression, could be something like a mood disorder, bipolar, et cetera. But half don't.
Yes.
And I think that's key, because for the half that don't, we may not be paying the attention to those folks that we might need to be. And I know we're going to be talking about some of the signs and symptoms or some of the early detection opportunities that we have. But just to name that, I think is an important piece, because those folks in, that aren't in therapy or don't show signs of a depression or an anxiety or mood disorder, we may not be looking at some of the things that could be important for us to understand that place them at risk. But let me ask you this. You know, we know that one's life experiences, one, their upbringing, early traumas play into our lives just in general. But in terms of suicide, how does one's life experiences, one's upbringing, life traumas along the way, how do those play into some of the suicidal thought that one might be experiencing?
Yes, I appreciate you for bringing that question up, in part because, you know, I talked about mental health issues, but definitely trauma has a factor when it comes to suicide risk. And when people have been exposed to trauma and have not gotten treatment, perhaps have stuffed some of those experiences or emotions and are struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, either diagnosed or undiagnosed. And then after the trauma, they have all of these other complicated life circumstances or even repeat trauma.
Exactly.
Complex trauma or trauma over trauma.
Yes.
Chronic over time, in the absence of any protective factors, or like what we call in the field, like things that buffer against risk. And, you know, the number one thing in the literature that buffers against these sorts of things is social support. You know, having people in your life that you can rely on during times of need, whether that's, and I shouldn't say just during times of need, but during all the time. So whether you're having a struggle and you need an ear or somebody to process or listen to what's going on and help you sort through it, or during everyday life when you need some fun and friendship, all of those things matter.
You bet. You know, you're talking about how those that are traumatized early in life tend to have a story that has repeat traumas related to it. Oftentimes, some of those traumas unknowingly keep one from developing some of this, you know, strategies that make relationships healthy. It could be around boundaries or communication, and therefore they're vulnerable and susceptible to repeat traumas. And I'm sure you see that in the work that you do.
Yes, it's always amazing to me. People have a hard time understanding, for example, that someone could be victimized more than once.
Exactly.
When you'll see on the national news an incident or something, I don't know, to deal with domestic violence or sexual assault or something, and they'll say, surely somebody would not let that happen to them more than once.
Exactly.
As if they were in control or in charge of what happened when they, you know, were victimized. And what you see is that people that have experienced those types of traumas, it's not uncommon for them to come into a clinical setting and say, I was sexually assaulted at 15 and again at 20 and a third time, and now I'm coming into care.
Yeah. It's so important to understand that, not from a critical view, like, hey, what about your first lesson didn't you learn?
Yes, it's not that.
We become judgmental, we can stereotype those moments. But what we understand really from the clinical perspective is that when they're traumatized, they become more vulnerable unknowingly.
Yes.
Put themselves in situations or don't know how to handle situations, or maybe there's a set of beliefs that they take away from that early trauma that makes it susceptible for certain kinds of people coming into their lives. So there's, it's like you're saying, it's not an easy topic, but these things are all key pieces to how traumas truly do play into repeat traumas. And also at some point where people get discouraged or, you know, desperate, or they just become despairing, suicide becomes a way to maybe alleviate some of that pain.
A way out from the pain. That's what I hear from our surviving, those that have made an attempt and that are still with us today. Absolutely. That they want the pain to go away. They didn't really want to die. And you're reminding me of the trauma of a family member that has died by suicide too. And we should probably talk about that. You know, when you have been exposed to suicide through your family, you see that it can follow generations in a family. And you can have a family that you interview that have had a dad and an uncle and perhaps a grandfather that have all either made attempts or have completed suicide. And it does become a way out or an acceptable answer in a particular family system if we're not careful and we don't intervene, and all the stigma that goes with talking about that within a family, and the secrets and just things like that that occur also can be traumatic, and people carry that with them generation over generation. There's new research that have come out that have said that when one person dies by suicide, over 130 people are impacted, are exposed. And I saw this play out in my work with the military. When you're in a small unit and one of your fellow service members dies by suicide and they were right there with you all the time, that unit is like a family. And they begin to think, well, I have the same set of problems as that person, and maybe that is an okay way out. And if we wonder how suicide has this ripple effect across the nation, well, if one person dies and 135 people are impacted, and we know that 123 people die by suicide every day in the U.S., and I can't do math like that, but 123 times 135 people, you quickly see the ripple effect of people in such a way that most everybody knows somebody who has attempted or completed suicide. There's not a time I don't go give a talk about this topic that there's not a few people staying after to tell me that they want to share their story and that they were impacted and that they've not talked about it.
I did a podcast recently for Mental Health Month in May, and I was trying to put something into perspective. Mental Health Month is about raising awareness. And I said, by the time that we're done with this podcast, 25 minutes, 37 people will have taken their lives worldwide every 40 seconds.
Wow.
And so when you're putting these things into perspective, not only is the incident rate so very high and the people that are impacted, it is significant. In fact, I've heard very similar stories. Those that I've worked with, either the hospital or my private practice, that has survived suicide, the common denominator is exactly what you said. It's, Graham, I didn't necessarily want to die. I just wanted the pain to stop.
Yes.
That's it. I just wanted the pain to stop. And the same thing, we're talking about that generational legacy, where for some families in their narrative, suicide almost becomes a coping strategy, doesn't it? It sounds like a coping strategy. What are you talking about? But at the end of some things that aren't working, it can become as a way out. It's a way to be seen to manage things that just get to be too bad.
Yes. And when they feel like particularly they're a burden on their family or on society. If you haven't had the chance to interview Kevin Hines, Kevin is a suicide survivor who spends his life now giving talks and educating others about what it feels like to be a survivor and to make an attempt by suicide at the Golden Gate Bridge in California. But he says that exact same thing, not only that he wanted the pain to go away, but that he wanted to know that someone cared about his plight. And as he was, you know, going to make his attempt, he tells this in-depth story about, you know, I just wanted someone to ask me, are you okay? What's wrong with you? Are you okay?
Yeah. I want to talk about that point. Is it okay to talk to somebody about this? But let me go to something first. We know that early detection and early intervention is so important in mental health, just period. With regard to suicide, share with us some of the typical warning signs that we can become more aware of, such that we might be able to have some early detection and some greater opportunity for an early intervention. What do you typically see?
Yeah, this is also such a good question, because there is, I think, this myth out there that says it just happened, there were no signs. And I just don't believe that. I have, you know, led many teams and groups that have done psychological autopsies over the course of the years on suicides that have happened, and people have studied, and we've even interviewed family members and qualitative reviews of supervisors that have interacted with people in the days and months leading up to their death. And I absolutely do believe that there are signs. And the issue with the signs, in some cases, one person knows one sign, one person knows another risk and another, and maybe one person doesn't know all that's going on with a person. For example, they might know they lost a job, so unemployment can be a risk factor. They might know that they, you know, had recently had a breakup. That can certainly be a risk factor. They might know that they're drinking more than normal. That could be a risk factor. But they might not know collectively all of the risk factors. Really? And so I think, you know, that's, you know, certainly I think that that's at play. But if somebody talks about suicide risk, then that's absolutely, you know, the highest risk. If they say, they might not use the exact words, I want to die by suicide, but what they will do is they'll use coded language. I just want the pain to end.
Yeah.
They'll say, I don't want to be here anymore. And right. That can be really hard to interpret, especially right. For someone who hasn't, you know, gotten the skills or the training to figure that out. The other risk factors that come to mind or signs for me are things like not being able to come up with a reason to live. Like say that, so they feel hopeless and they feel helpless and just this extraordinary emotional pain. So hopefully people know what emotional pain looks like. You know, you can sometimes just see it on people's faces. But if you can't see it and you're not comfortable and you don't know the person, so you don't interact with them enough, we often talk about asking, you know, asking the question directly.
Well, let me just go to that right now then. You know, it's not uncommon, like you're saying, for someone that's experienced another that's taken their life by suicide. You know, we'll typically hear, like you're saying, them share that, you know, they saw some signs, maybe one or two, maybe not all the signs, but maybe some. And they share that they were afraid maybe to raise them, or maybe they didn't know how to raise them. And maybe they even were concerned that if I actually raise this with a person, begin to talk about it, could I possibly tip them, you know, in that direction? So maybe I didn't think to bring it up. So let me ask you this. Will talking with somebody, addressing them about it, will it actually cause the person to think about it more and actually act on it?
Yeah, it's a myth. The people do believe that. And I can understand why people believe that. I can see. But, you know, they have studied this out time and time again to come to the conclusion that, you know, asking people about suicide risk and even using the word suicide does not put the idea in their mind in that it's actually the opposite, mm-hmm. that someone cares about you so much that they took that risk and that they had that vulnerable sort of emotionally charged conversation with you. Yeah. And so it is okay. And we recommend people not even beat around the bush about it.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you that too. So you're talking earlier about maybe some of the warning signs. So you might say, you know, hey, you're, you know, maybe a despair or looking down or losing a job or maybe a family history, or maybe you're drinking more, your sleep seems to be disrupted. So craft some language for us. If someone just were to enter into and begin to ask somebody about it, you're saying kind of just be bold. And if you're clumsy, you're clumsy, but you're caring. Put it out there. So it might sound like what?
Yes, I appreciate the way you said it too, in terms of clumsy. If it's a bumpy conversation, it's probably more authentic, and that's okay. Yeah. But I do recommend people even try it. Like, ask a friend who you're not worried about is at risk, just to get right. the words out.
Yeah.
But you can summarize what you see. So you summarize what you see that they're experiencing. Right. I see that you're under a lot of stress at work. I see that you've recently been furloughed, or I see that you're unemployed. And I know that you're worried about your mortgage. I know that you're worried about your finances. And you shared that you and your wife have been arguing quite a bit about this. Is it getting to the point where you're thinking that you want to end your life? Is it getting to that point? Or is the pain so difficult? Do you feel so overwhelmed that you've thought of suicide? And I also teach people to just say, you know, I just have to ask you this question because I care about you.
Yeah.
Like to like tee it up, because people are so worried to like get the words out.
Well, like you said earlier, though, it's a great point. Most, maybe even like the gentleman you mentioned, he was just hoping that someone might ask. And so basically, you know, I've clumsily walked through and, you know, the conversation and basically said, you got to bear with me. I'm not even sure if I got the right words here, but here's what I'm noticing. And can I ask, are you thinking about this? And if you are, can you talk about it?
We had funded a study from an office that I was running. We had funded a study about suicide risk in social media. And it was really about whether or not people put their signs and symptoms of suicide risk on social media. And this was when, early on in the social media kind of trajectory. And we were getting the results, and the results were just very crystal clear that people were. They were writing on social media, on open platforms, that they were going through divorce and that they were drinking a lot, and they were even showing pictures of firearms.
Wow.
And it was, and so I was beginning to think about my own social media and the fact that I have, you know, people on social media that I've not interacted with for 20 plus years for no particular reason, but they're on social media. And one in particular stood out for me that had all the signs and symptoms. All the risks were there. And here I work in the field. And it wasn't until I got those study results that I thought, you know, I should reach out to this person.
Right.
But at the same time, I thought, I'm not the right person because, yes, I might be in the field and, you know, I might, you know, pride myself on being a good social worker. I have not spoken to her in 20 years. Like, I'm probably not the right person to ask the question. Right. But I did feel very drawn and inclined to do it.
Uh-huh.
So I did call her. I did ask her. And she said, I think of suicide every morning when I wake up and I think of it every day before I fall asleep.
Man.
And she said, and you know, nobody's asked me that.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? And it's sometimes so prevalent. And I've heard people say the same thing. They said, Graham, these are the ones that survived, obviously. They said, no one even asked me. I know people care and love me, but no one just asked. And all I needed was to get the conversation going. How cool for you, even if it'd been 25 years and you felt maybe a little awkward in doing so, just to kind of push past that and say, you know what? Maybe we haven't spoken, but here's what I'm seeing. Can you help me understand? And to someone yes. have to be so grateful for you saying, you know what? Thanks for asking, because every single day, here's what I wake up with. So where did just real quick, where did it go from there, Kita?
So it was bumpy, even for me as a clinician in the field, it was bumpy. And I wasn't sure if she would even remember me because like, just because you're on social media with someone, they don't know, they have hundreds of people. So I sort of started the conversation with like, I'm not sure if you remember me, I'm Kita.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, I'm from this town Massachusetts. And she said, yes, I remember you. And I even with my skills, I said, I work in the field of suicide and I just got some study results and I'm thinking about you. And I just felt inclined to phone you because I have to ask, are you thinking of ending your life by suicide?
You know what I love about that? there are no right words for you to say, you know what? Those were the perfect words to get through to me. Sometimes it's just saying, I care about you. Here's what I'm seeing. And I don't know how to understand it or even if a conversation is warranted, but can I just get it started with you? And you can let me know one way or the other. And after that, the floodgates seemed to open.
Yes. And this was domestic violence. It was unemployment, domestic violence.
Oh, yeah.
It was childhood trauma, multiple traumas over time, and lack of knowing how to access resources. Like our resource system is complicated. And like getting in the system and getting an appointment with the right person and knowing like, do you go to a social worker or a psychologist? And where do you go? How do you start? Like just, we think everyone knows how to just pick up the phone and find a professional, but that's just not the case. It's a little complicated.
Yeah, it is.
For some, especially when they're in the throes of crisis. They're just not thinking clearly enough to know like, I, you know, like talked with her. So do you have insurance or do you not? Okay, so how do people who don't have insurance access mental health care in your state? And we just like had to unpack it. And in the interim, like, is there a group you could maybe go to, some support groups? Like, where are the groups back there now? Like, I don't know. I haven't been back to that state in a while. Like, and so like just a little pointing in the right direction, you know?
Just getting curious with her and being willing to push. And this is the part that stands out to me. Being willing to push through your own kind of uncomfortableness or kind of wondering if it's okay. Just enough to say, you know what? I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Just to find out. And we're talking possibly saving a life, 130 plus other people that would have been impacted, maybe a generational thing that gets to be put into motion. Who knows? But it's one life and that impacts so many. So nice job. It's a great story. Nice job. And maybe for us listening and interacting with you to say, hey, maybe if, you know, Kita's pushing past, you know, her uncomfortableness and she's an expert in this field, maybe we can do the same thing and just try. You know, we're talking about suicide too, and we're talking about some of the signs. I trust that there are demographic differences too, whether it's, you know, young and old, you work with the military, maybe veterans versus civilians.
Yes.
Just in a nutshell, what are you noticing in the demographics?
A couple different things about that. Definitely trauma, common core thread. So that to me means whether you're talking about military and veteran and potential for wartime trauma or lifetime prevalence rates of trauma, which could be anything from assault, to car accident and every sort of thing in between, but also trauma in certain vulnerable populations. So when you're talking about Native Americans and the trauma that they've been through as a community, also for me, rural areas. So people that live in rural areas that historically don't have access to resources and things that those of us take for granted outside of the rural area are at particular risk. And so this idea of like having to drive long distances to go to weekly therapy, or, you know, there's not a psychiatrist in my community except for the third Tuesday of the month for these short hours. And the people that live in those areas are at increased risk. And part of it for me too is all that goes with that. So you're living in an area where maybe there's not a lot of access to jobs. And if you lose the one you have, that can be problematic. Not a lot of access to services, not a lot of access to social support. And also, if you do something wrong in that community, you sometimes stand alone. And that can also be very tragic and sad when people do something wrong. They need people to rally around them and support them, yes, not to run from them and have them feel less than.
Yes. Yeah. That's really good. You know, as you're talking about kind of a broader demographic understanding that goes along with some of the signs and symptoms you talked about earlier, I know, and you just recently kind of gave us a nice entree into raising this with somebody. I think it's important too, as you're raising this, to actually include in the discussion, if you're noticing some things with people, hey, you know, you're kind of in this age group or you're in this demographic and I'm seeing some of these signs, not just naming those signs and symptoms, but adding the question. And you know, sometimes these things can really mount up, can't they? And they can become very burdensome, very heavy. And before we know it, we're looking for a way out. We can look for a way out in a number of ways. We can, you know, substances, alcohol, withdrawal, all those things, risky behaviors. Have you ever thought about maybe suicide as a way out? And we're sometimes afraid to even use the word suicide. We almost want to say, have you ever thought about maybe exiting or taking your life? Use the word suicide.
Yeah. I think that's beautiful the way you described it, and just this idea that things can become so much.
Yes.
Burdened so much, like, is that literally what it is? Their cup runneth over.
Yeah.
And so they are overwhelmed by their capacity to cope.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good. You're talking about too, even with the person you spoke with on social media, how we access services. How are you encouraging folks to do that? Maybe some of the resources that might be some great starting points for them to begin with. Give us some resources and some kind of a path here.
Yeah, first and foremost, I want to make sure folks know about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, because that is the one spot shop. If all of your listeners would put the Lifeline in their phone and have it ready and have it labeled Crisis Line 1-800-273-8255, that would be terrific. And then what we know is people like to text, and they, believe it or not, will text the crisis text line. And equally so, if they text home to 741-741, that's also an immediate response. The nation right now is doing quite a bit of work to try to get a three-digit number. Maybe you've heard about that.
No, I haven't heard about that. Tell me.
Okay, so this is the 988. So they're trying to get a three-digit number, kind of like 911, but 988 for suicide risk, so that it's cool, so that people don't have to remember 1-800-273-8. Right. So there's a lot of congressional movement, and hopefully we're close to getting something like that passed for the nation. But otherwise, at PsychHub, I have to tell you too about our resources at PsychHub. We recognize the role of education, and it's about educating people on the same things what you and I've talked about today. Okay. So risk factors, protective factors. We develop a number of short, easily understandable videos with animation to kind of explain what is depression, or even what is cognitive behavioral therapy? How does it work for suicide risk? What to do if you're worried about a loved one who's using substances? So we have a library of probably close to 200 of these short videos. They're all free, and they can be pushed out to people across different platforms and things like that. But also, most importantly, they can be seen by anybody, anywhere. They're not focused on clinicians. They're focused on everyday people. So we also develop resource guides and smart sheets. We've just finished a resource guide about racism and mental health, and how those two factors play together, and how there are resources out there available for people that are struggling with oppression, with, you know, what's going on in the nation right now. We also finished a toolkit recently about COVID and mental health and the long-term implications of physical or social distancing. So if people go to psychhub.com, they'll see a host of free resources available, and just educate yourself. The more you know, the better you can do.
I love that. So the more we know, the better we can do. Well, I know we're kind of winding down on our time. Keita, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great to be with you and great to have you just imprint on this topic of suicide. And suicide is such really an important topic for all of us to be aware of. Today's podcast gives us some great understanding that it doesn't have to be occurring at the rate that it is. And most importantly, there are things that we can do for ourselves, for others around us, if we reach that desperate place, or we see them reaching that desperate place, and things that we can do for others that are experiencing this kind of ideation. So this gives us hope. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your willingness to talk about the topic as well. Thanks.
It's been fantastic. You know, we recognize that suicide is an important topic for all of us to be addressing, and Behavioral Health Today will continue to address this area in our upcoming and future podcasts. And to those of you listening, thanks so much for being with us. And we look forward to having you join us on our next podcast with Behavioral Health Today.
Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Triad Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.